Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. I am John Manuel. I'm joined this week again by J.J. Cooper, and we're coming to you live from the Baseball America DeMarini Demo House podcast nook, which is very exciting. Proud to have DeMarini Demo House as our sponsor. And when it comes to buying a baseball bat, DeMarini just changed the game, introducing Demo House, where you can step into the cage and hit the latest from DeMarini before you buy, because there's no substitute for hitting a real baseball or talking to people who know both bats and batting. Your demo time in the cage is free, so get the season started right. Visit your nearest demo house today. Locations and full details can be found at demarini.com/demo house. And JJ, I know that would have been a great idea. My son's a little older. Looking forward to getting him. I did get him his first bat, but it was a little discounted, I'll put it that way, for Christmas. And when he gets a little bit older and actually swings it around a little bit, after I get him on his long toss program, first.
But long tossing is key for
That's you, first for Alex. Alex will be first on his long toss program, then we'll get him in the cage. I'm hoping that he'll be a nice
Natalie's
situational
a little ways
lefty.
Away. She just turned two, so she would use it as a, you know, clubbing the dog with it or something.
Sophia actually got her first pink glove for Christmas.
Hey.
So Merry Christmas. Happy holidays to everybody listening in. And our first podcast of 2010 here in the Demo House podcast nook. And J.J., a fairly uneventful holiday season for Major League Baseball, but then this week, everyone's back at work.
Kind of thawed out a little bit and started making moves again.
Yeah, we have Adrian Beltre signing in Boston. We have Matt Holliday signing back in St. Louis for a lot of money.
Shocking! That was one of those like negotiate. Okay, how much are you going to negotiate against yourself? Because
Seemed that way. Jason Bay signing in New York. So
negotiate with yourself.
That's right.
That was really one was like, no, I want more money.
Really?
Well, we're the only team that's offering you money.
And the Mets, we'll wait. We'll keep bidding against ourselves, but we'll wait. And let's see if they bid against themselves for Benji Molina now, as they've been rumored to do. But the Red Sox are involved in a lot of moves this first week of January, with also the rumor of this possible trade with them and the Mariners, which I'm sure will be out by the time people download this, with the Casey Kochman moving on. Mike Lowell, a trade that never happened, that hasn't happened yet. So it's natural, I think, also to talk about all these Red Sox moves and to go into our American League East Top 10 Prospect issue, fronted by Brian Mattis and the Orioles. He was on the cover of that. I think we're all done with the American League East chats online.
Yes.
We're on to the American League Central. So we're going to talk a little American League East. This issue, and also we might touch on the Central.
But
and
Central we got next week. We'll
right,
be coming
we'll really
back
dive
with
more
full
into, absolutely. And then we'll have a bonus podcast, I believe, this weekend from Dallas with Aaron Fitt and myself. Head out to Dallas for the American Baseball Coaches Association Convention. We might even get special guest Dave Kylis to finally come on the podcast so we can start doing Dave Kylis impersonations thereafter so everyone will know what we're referencing. That would be useful.
The college podcast will maybe, even now with more Dave Kylis imitations.
We might get even more Dave Kylis imitations, and that's hard to believe. But J.J., American League East, obviously the biggest thing that sticks out about the American League East is the Yankees, the world champions, the Red Sox, with their success. You have four World Series championships from those two teams. I'm not even sure how many pennants. I think the Yankees lost a couple World Series in the decade, as well as winning a couple.
And the
Rays.
Team that also made the World Series.
That's right. And the Rays won a World Series.
This is the group of death.
This is the group of death. That's a great way to put it. It's the group of death. And yet, I feel so. I want to start talking maybe more about the have-nots as opposed to the Yankees and Red Sox. Out of those three organizations, Tampa, Baltimore, Toronto, how would you rank them in terms of hope for the future?
Well,
near both near future and long term.
You got to go Tampa first because we are talking about a team that a year ago was in the World Series.
I think so too.
I know they didn't make the playoffs this year, but that was kind of I think you could say that was a very natural drop off. They may have overachieved a little bit in 2008, and so they kind of returned, and also they were playing in a monster division, and the economic limitations really hit them a little bit more this year. They did not make any big moves at the trade deadline.
Right. No, you're right.
And I think part of that is they just don't have, I can understand why they don't have the finances to, they want to, they went to the World Series, they won a pennant in 2008, and it wasn't something where they were turning people away at the turnstiles in 2009.
That's for sure. And I think the other thing is there's still a team, it's still a market, I think it's always going to be a market, no matter how successful they are, where if they make a mistake on Pat Burrell, which they did, they had some money to spend, they went out and spent it on Pat Burrell, it didn't work out, the Red Sox or Yankees can just brush those mistakes away, most of the big market teams, the Angels, and the Angels make a mistake on Gary Matthews Jr. They just spend to make up for that mistake. The Mets make a lot of mistakes. They keep on trying to spend their way out of mistakes. The Rays just can't do that, so they're going to have to continue to be on that scouting and player development tip, which has served them well in recent years with some other really good trades, you know, that have worked out very well for them.
And the thing about it is if you look at their top 10, they've got a fascinating situation. They have big league ready starting pitchers who you can't find a spot for in the rotation.
It's a good problem to have for them because they
not many teams have that problem.
And they had an extra guy. He's not nearly as high a ceiling, but Mitch Talbot is a guy who we've seen here in Durham for the last three seasons.
Many times.
And they just traded him for a starting catcher in Kelly Shopik. I mean, granted, that was kind of a salary dump by the Indians, but Mitch Talbot is a 25, 26-year-old, big league ready starting pitcher who was like 9th or 10th on the depth chart for Tampa.
I mean, and they have, I mean, if you like map out their starting rotation for this year, it really is. It's like, okay, well, Hellickson, if you think maybe that Jeremy Hellickson's not ready right now, which I think there's a lot of argument that he is, but if he's not.
But you could make the point that, you know, another half year won't kill him for sure.
But by June or July, you sure would think that he's ready, you know, if everything goes right. And barring injuries, which admittedly injuries often happen in pitching, but, you know, barring injury, it's hard to find really, you know, where he's going to fit in the short term.
Right. I mean, Wade Davis is penciled in as their number 5 starter, and the number 6 guys, oh, by the way, Andy Sonnenstein.
Oh, yeah, by the way.
Who doesn't have great stuff, but did win 14 games in the big leagues, and pitched, but basically, whether you want to, I saw a quote or a comment online on a message board with all the hoo-ha about the Hall of Fame going on that called wins a bogus stat, which I think is just hilarious. Wins are not the best way to evaluate a pitcher.
Right.
That's clearly, we know that now. I think we've always known that, to be honest with you.
No, well, not maybe. Maybe not. Maybe not. I would say if you went back actually to the 70s and all, I think it was thought of.
Well, I think people actually probably back then might have thought ERA was a better way, and maybe that's not the, and that's not probably not the best way either. I think you depend on who you talk to.
Cy Young and all though, like Bob Welch was always going to win if he got because he had 27.
I understand that 27 also is an out. I mean, who's won 27 in the last 35 years? I'm not saying he was the best pitcher, but I understand why when someone goes out there enough to win 27 games, I understand why that someone's going to notice
that. I think the argument was, he was clearly the best pitcher.
I can't go back in the time machine, so I don't want to argue the time machine. But I think that the saying wins are a bogus stat misses the point that the point of baseball games is to win. I'm not saying that's a pitcher's job. It's the team's job, though. So I just think it's the stupidest thing ever to say that wins are a bogus stat. Wins aren't the best stat. I think we need to get our semantics a little bit more in tune with reality. Andy Sonnenstein winning 14 games 2 years ago is not the greatest indicator that, he's a great pitcher. But he has proved he can grind his way through a major league season in a big league rotation in the American League East. My point is I think Andy Sonnenstein's a very solid back-end starter that a lot of teams would kill for, and he's like 6th or 7th at best for Tampa, which is the reason why I agree with you. And not just those pitchers, but also Desmond Jennings is a guy that I'm enamored with and I think is an elite-level prospect. Proved that he could be a full season, go through a full season healthy. He's got all 5 tools. I think he's an impact guy for Tampa in 2010 if they need him to be.
Yeah, I mean, he's ready. You know, if they need him, he's there and ready. Now the question again becomes, you know, well, is there going to be a spot for him to kind of, you know, make an early impact?
Well, there's no right fielder in Tampa right now. I mean, I guess right now it's basically him and Matt Joyce battling for that right field role.
It is one of the things, like, if that happens, it's like, how long before you say, okay, BJ, you know.
That's the other big question, is BJ Upton. I mean, he was pretty terrible in 2009. And at what point do you just get tired of these guys' shenanigans? A guy who just doesn't, who is tantalizing with his talent but doesn't come through on his talent. I think, Delmon Young, his former teammate, is a great example of that. I mean, the Twins were getting pretty tired of Delmon's tantalizing talent and not performing, and then he finally did perform toward the end of last year. Now, whether he'll maintain that or not is a very big question, I think a very legitimate question to ask. But I like Tampa's entire list. I think Reed Brignac would have been in the big leagues a year or two ago in a different organization. I think he'd be a big league starter in a lot of other clubs because I think he's a short. I think he has a lot of value. He's their number 5 prospect.
And Jake McGee, I know he's coming off of Tommy John, but as a number 8 prospect, you know, by midseason, if he shows that he's back fully healthy and all, that's another guy, you know, who could be very helpful for them at some point before too long, or it's a great trade chip.
Absolutely. And we, you know, number six on the list is Tim Beckham, who was the number one overall pick in 2008. Was he the best prospect in 2008? No, but I think
they had to do it over. Would you maybe not pick him number one?
Very possibly. I think there's a lot of I still think he's a guy who's going to has a very good shot at being a big league regular, whether it's at third base or in the outfield. You know, remains to be seen. Probably won't be shortstop, but I do think he's pretty good. I think there's a pretty big gap, though. I think there's a big gap between Tampa and, in my mind, Baltimore would be the next best farm system of these three we're talking about. I would actually say Baltimore is the next best farm system in the entire division, but Baltimore and Boston are two very different organizations.
Right. Baltimore, the thing that they have is that, and Baltimore's farm system, you remember when we're talking about farm system, several of their guys who are elite-level guys don't qualify for the farm system anymore. We saw several, you know, promotions to the big leagues.
Yeah, Chris Tillman is the big, most notable, I guess. They lost.
Matt Wieters was, you know, I mean, he was, you know, he's the rookie last year. And hey, yes, it may not have been the, you know, the season to end all seasons and all, but at the same time, if you're an Orioles fan, still the cornerstone around which you build.
I do wonder who really expected him to have the season to end all seasons, as some projection systems had him having. I wonder how many people actually thought that was possible.
But you look at them and you say, okay, the Orioles in 2011, you can map out if they can develop a couple more or acquire a couple of more hitters, you could really see by 11 how things could start going in the right direction for them.
I could actually see it coming just from internally. I'm a Brandon Snyder believer myself, and I believe that not every player on the team has to fit the profile. And to me, if the Orioles are getting the kind of power they've been getting from center field that they've got, I know they don't get huge, the power they're going to get from Matt Wieters behind the plate, the fact that Brian Roberts is a good offensive second baseman, I think Josh Bell is the key. If Josh Bell comes through at third base and gives you a power play at third base, I think it's fine if Brandon Snyder's potentially a 290 to 310 hitting. If he's a right-handed hitting Mark Grace type.
And ideally a number, you know, like the number two.
A number six hole hitter type of guy. Because I think, to me, 2 years from now, Orioles lineup of Brian Roberts, probably Nick Markakis, Adam Jones, Matt Wieters, Nolan Reimold, Brandon Snyder. You know, I'm leaving out Josh Bell. Josh Bell in the middle of that. You're talking about Snyder hitting sixth or seventh. You know, to me, the biggest issue for them is a long-term shortstop. They still don't have one internally. Cesar Ristoros, in my mind, is a great placeholder, a good defensive player, gives your pitchers confidence. I think the Orioles have the makings of a Rays-type revival, a Rays-type team.
Right.
They don't have the depth the Rays have, but they have the impact pitchers like Tampa. I love Chris Tillman. Got to like Brian Mattis. I like Brandon Irby. I like Jake Garriott. I like Zach Britton. You know, they have strength in numbers. I wouldn't have necessarily ranked their guys exactly like Will did, but Will's done their farm system for a long time now. And he was down to one organization this year because of all the books he had to edit. But he still held on to the Orioles like grim death. I'm doing the Orioles top 30, which I think is just hilarious of all organizations to hold on to. But they finally have some hope. I would want to keep doing them while they're finally turning things around.
And I like what they did last year in a way in that I like that they got the first wave of pitching prospects up. That the first wave was the less elite guys.
Right, Bergeson, Birkin, there's one other
David
guy.
Hernandez.
David Hernandez.
You know, those guys, they got them up. And the great thing about that is you can kind of sort through those guys and figure out, you know, okay, one of these guys may be better than you thought he was. One of
Bergeson.
These guys may be worse than you thought he was.
Birkin.
Yeah, exactly. One of these guys, hey, he's not going to be a starter for us long term, but you know what? David Hernandez may be a solid guy in our pen.
I think they did find out that Bergeson and Hernandez have a chance to be contributors when the team is a championship caliber team or ready to contend. I think Bergeson's a perfect 4/5 profile guy. I think Hernandez has a really good chance to be a very effective middle reliever. I think Birkin could be a long guy for him, but I think when they're contending, and I think we both like the Kevin Millwood trade for them.
Yeah.
Just because they had to have a veteran stabilizer guy who can, I don't like his chances of being great in the American League East.
No.
But he's a pro.
But 2010, have him and Guthrie at the top end of the rotation to where you're not putting that much pressure on your
Tillman and Mattis.
Your Mattises.
And Bergeson. Right. I think he should, and the thing is, I think Millwood should make Guthrie better. Because in 07 and 08, Jeremy Guthrie was a slightly above average big league starter. A number 3-4 guy on a championship caliber team. And he had a masquerade as a one. I think it wore him down last year. I think he had way too much pressure on him all three of those years. Let's see if Jeremy Guthrie can come back and with Millwood helping him relieve some of those burdens from him being as a staff leader, if that can make Jeremy Guthrie better. It's a Baseball America podcast with John and JJ.
And we're coming to you from the DeMarini
right.
Demo House podcast.
That's right. And then we have email to the DeMarini Demo House inbox. And it's from Brian, who's a Red Sox fan. A good time as ever. Really, as little time as we can talking about the Blue Jays top 30, probably the better.
I was going to, you know, you got to like at least, they've done one thing right, which is they had to trade Halliday, and they traded him, and they got a solid package for him.
They got better prospects for Roy Halliday back than the Twins got back for Johan Santana. It's really not close. And it seems like they had, you know, I guess they had a bigger pool of teams that were competing, and that helped them get a better return on the Roy Halladay
trade. But whatever it is, you know, that's like, I'll say this, it's that, you know, you look at an Alex Anthopoulos, the first couple of moves have, you know, he's survived the first off season,
yep.
and I mean by survived, like, he went into it with a difficult scenario, which is, a guy that you need to trade, and everyone knows you need to trade.
Yep.
And we saw in Johan Santana's case that sometimes you could end up getting a lot less for that than you think
absolutely.
You would.
Absolutely. And, you know, 6 of their top 10 prospects acquired in trades, and this is a lot about how the Jays have drafted and developed. Of late, they have graduated a lot of prospects to the big leagues, but I think we talked about that actually in the last podcast when we talked about the Halliday trade. So so Brian emailed us about the Red Sox top 10. He actually did a two-parter. The Sox top 10 appears to have a few players who people don't hesitate to rate as plus defenders, but the question lies in their bats. Raymond Fuentes, Jose Iglesias, Derek Gibson, and how well they develop. My question is, how did Tae-Shwan Lin get left off this list? He's their best defensive outfielder and hitter, and hitter with the best strike zone discipline. He's put up decent numbers, age appropriate. How's he below Fuentes, who has a little track record to speak of? Does Fuentes really have tools that are that much better than Lin's? That's part one of the question. I guess the answer is a resounding yes.
Yeah. I mean, like, Fuentes' bat is just... I mean, the question with Lin is that Lin's bat is a big question. I mean, how much authority is he going to hit? You know, is he going to be a... You know, if you're slugging, you know, 350, 360 in the minor leagues...
Yeah.
You know, it... Yeah, I mean...
He's kind of a tweener, it sounds like, offensively. You know, there's not a... There's not a separator for him. Is he an on-base guy? Is he a power guy? Is he a speed guy? He seems like he's more
he's
of
a little
tweener.
Bit of, and he's a little bit of the last two. He's,
yeah.
he's a little bit of an on-base bat, but he's not a, you know, as of yet, he's not a, you know, a guy who's going to hit, you know, get a 400 on-base, you know, to lead off, but not
right.
bad. He's got good, you know, he has a good feel for the strike zone. And then he's a good runner. No, he's not Fuentes as a runner, probably, but, you know. But he's a good runner.
But the scouting report that Jim Callis wrote on Raymond Fuentes also says polished bat, and I think that is a big difference. And I think that the Red Sox probably would not be drafting Raymond Fuentes with the back of the first round if it weren't for the fact that he has some of these other tools, some of these center field tools, and they saw some polish in the bat, a significant amount of polish that made them be that aggressive about drafting Raymond Fuentes. So, you know, obviously Jim felt pretty strongly. I don't think Derek Gibson also would be a guy who would be thrown into the defense first pool.
Right. If you want to say that for Iglesias, that's absolutely. I think that completely fits with Iglesias.
Absolutely. And I think Derek Gibson's more of an offensive guy, you know, who's got probably a chance to move from shortstop to second base and be an offensive second baseman. The second part was Michael Bowden comparing to Junichi Tozawa. Stuff seems awfully similar. The guy off the list seemed to have a better track record. Did anyone really expect Tozawa to add that much velocity to his fastball? Brian, you know, the reports I got on the Eastern League on Junichi Tozawa, and if you look at the pitch effects reports on him in the big leagues, his velocity is pretty good, actually, in the big leagues. It fell off in September in his first year in the United States that he wore down a little bit. I mean, that's almost to be expected, especially considering the guy threw in 135 innings, first full season in the big leagues. I can kind of see why his velocity would go down a little bit, but, you know, he's touching 94 miles an hour pretty regularly during the year. I specifically remember talking to Arnie Baylor, his manager, right before the Futures game. He had a truncated start because they thought he was going to pitch in the Futures game, and he went five innings on like 70 pitches, and his last couple pitches were 93 and 94. And he's got secondary stuff. So he's got, I think, a better delivery than Bowden, who's always had this arm action that's troubled people. The arm action seems to be contributing to his diminished velocity. It sounds like Bowden's stuff went backwards in 2009.
And Tozawa has a better breaking ball also.
I think so. I think Bowden's got his secondary stuff is pretty good, but I think it definitely went backwards.
It went backwards in 2009. If the curveball's back to what it was,
right,
the 2007, 2008 curveball, then maybe it's a different story. But
and the if you're a Red Sox fan, the problem is the Red Sox weren't able to sell high on Michael Bowden when his numbers in the minor leagues were quite good, and when he was able to maintain average stuff. I think it was always average stuff with plus pitchability and then deception that made everything play up. And now I think it's probably fringy stuff that maybe plays average because of the deception. I just think the guy didn't have a ton of margin for error in the first place, and I think the Red Sox kind of missed their chance. I'm sure they tried. It sounds like they definitely tried.
Right.
Although, with him,
it's like it is. It's that margin error that, you know, hey, if the arm bounces back just a little bit this year, then he's back to being the same prospect, at least, that he was in 2007, 2008.
Well, fascinating tidbit that Jim had in the prospect handbook, which is off to the printers and will be shipped out here in mid to late January. One of the most fascinating parts of the book is when Jim was writing in the Red Sox top 10. I didn't go back and edit it into the Yankees, but it did make me go back and average out the Yankees guys. But I don't remember the exact number, but the average signing bonus for the Red Sox top 10 players is a pretty outrageously high signing bonus. And it actually would be an instructive thing for us to do. It would be a great blog post, actually,
yeah,
to go back and average up the top 10 prospects in each top 30 in each organization, and here's their average signing bonus for those top 10 players. Because for the Red Sox, it was in excess of $1.7 million, if I recall correctly.
Which
it was even higher for the Red Sox than it was for the Yankees. And a big reason for that, one of these guys, Jose Iglesias, received, I believe it's a $6 million bonus. If it's not, yes, it was a $6.25 million bonus, which is actually the largest in Red Sox history. It's of Casey Kelly and Ryan Westmoreland, three of the top five bonuses in Red Sox history, all in the top 10. So that helps contribute to it. The Yankees, you know, you do have the biggest contract in draft history in their top 10 in Andrew Brackmann. JJ, what was your reaction when you saw me rank Brackmann 10 in the Yankees?
We've talked about Brackmann in the office some. And
this will be a great way to wrap it up.
You know, and it is something where, I mean, yes, there are concerns about Brackmann. I mean, hey.
There are more concerns than there are non-concerns.
Right. I mean, the fact is that you have to think a while back, you know, to think back to when Andrew Brackmann had a year that at the end of that year you went, man, there, you know, he really did some stuff this year.
That would have been 2005. That would have
been
the time where
You know, you're thinking back to a younger time.
Or you can think 2007 when he was in 2007 Hawaii Winter Baseball, where his numbers weren't great in Hawaii, but he was pretty electric in Hawaii.
Right. But, I mean, as far as actually having success on a mound, you have to go back to 2005. And that's
for consistent success,
yeah,
yes.
And that's, you know, that you're basically going back to his freshman year of college.
You are.
And that's a concern. I mean, hey, the number of guys who have, you know, admittedly there's a big injury in there, but
two big injuries, if you count the appendectomy, because that kept them off
right.
the mound in 2008.
But when you have that long of a stretch, there's understandably some question of, hey, you know, is this guy ever going to figure out? Especially because there were times last year where his stuff was just not that good either.
However, there were times in that
same outings where it would be like,
right.
wow, that was really good.
Yeah, that's the big question with Andrew Brackmann is, why do the Yankees give him so much money? I mean, I think the only answer to that could be that they legitimately thought they were buying him out of an NBA career. In that case, the ACC basketball fan in me says, ha! You know, ha! This guy was not an NBA player. But he is 6'11", and he is fairly mobile. Personally, I think the Yankees have overestimated his athleticism. I think he was he's a special athlete, and to me, he's more like on the Jeff Niemann athleticism line. And he's got to be he's got to be a lot stronger. To me, Jeff Niemann is so strong.
Right, but you're
powers his way through his
delivery. You're basically saying he's a slow twitch guy.
Yeah, I am.
I mean, he's
maybe he's a medium twitch guy. He's not, but he's not a fast.
Because Jeff Beeman's a slow twitch guy.
Right. This guy's not an athlete. This guy's not an athlete. Like, he's not. He's athletic maybe for a baseball player, but he's not a basketball athlete. Like, I mean, I don't know who's a basketball player. I mean, like even Austin Jackson. I think they overestimated Austin Jackson's athleticism a little bit.
If you want to talk, DeSean Jackson was, you know, I mean, like that was a okay. This
right.
was a premium
or
athlete.
Calvin Johnson,
yeah.
who was also a big-time yeah. baseball prospect. This guy's not that level of athleticism. He's just not. And I think that's why
and he never was.
I
mean, that's,
I think that's why he has these issues of repeating his delivery and repeating his velocity and being. You know, 88 one inning, and then within the same inning being 95, and there's no difference really in no really discernible difference in his effort or necessarily what he's doing. So I think Andrew Brackmann has significant issues. I also think he does still have significant upside. I don't think that can be ignored. And I think it's also, A, ranking him 10 is a sign of the Yankees consider him one of their top 10 prospects. That's for sure. B, I do think there are organizations that are going to have a hard time finding 10 better prospects for the Yankees. In terms of ceiling, DJ Mitchell's a good comp. DJ Mitchell's a guy who's 6 feet tall, is a sinker baller, and did have success in his first full pro season this year, much more success than Andrew Brackmann had. But he gets killed by left-handers, DJ Mitchell, and even his advocates in the Yankees organization are promoting this guy as a Ramiro Mendoza-type middle reliever. Not even the guys outside the organization I talk to or inside the organization are talking up DJ Mitchell as a future starter. He's going to exceed expectations to be a big league fourth or fifth starter. I'll take the ceiling of a guy like Brackmann, where the Yankees really do believe that he can be a frontline starting pitcher with two knockout pitches. Do I think he's going to do that? Not necessarily. I think he's got about a 20% chance to do that, maybe 10% chance. I do think he could be an impact relief pitcher down the line. That's where I see his role being. And I think that would be, even then, if he's a closer, I think he has more impact than a guy like a DJ Mitchell. That's why he ranked 10th for me.
And the thing about it is that one thing that you have to allow for is that when you talk about a guy who's 6'11", it does take, a lot of times it takes longer.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's something where, doesn't mean it ever is going to. It
took longer for Niemann.
But the light bulb can take a little longer to come on because the reality of it is, I mean, you know, it sounds like cliche, but scouts talk about it and it's true. If you're a 6-foot guy, it's a whole lot easier to be in control of your mechanics than if you're 6'11", because
just have body awareness.
Yeah, body control
yep.
is much tougher for a 6'11" guy. I mean, that's why you don't, you know, that's why there aren't a whole lot of 6'11" guy. I mean, when you see a guy who has some athleticism,
right.
it stands out. That's
right.
why a guy like, you know, Brackmann gets the money that, you know, is because it's, there's a reason that most NBA, you know, 7-foot centers, you know, there's a lot of stiff 7-foot centers
that's
because
right.
it's hard to not be stiff if you're 7 foot.
Yeah, NBA-wise, basketball-wise, I wonder what Andrew Brackmann's ceiling would be. That would be a great conversation to have with Marty Blake sometime. Where do they have Andrew Brackmann slotted in the NBA?
And it's something where you do have to, with the money when it comes to the two-sport guys, you don't throw it out, but it is a whole different story. Because,
yeah, just like Jeff Samardzija.
Because the reality of it is that, look, they don't deserve it. I mean, like, if you on a pure baseball terms, no.
Correct.
They don't deserve this much money. But because there's leverage, then all of a sudden that changes everything. And the reality is that there's probably, I mean, if you look at it, yeah, there's a lot of money that's been wasted on guys because they're two sports stars.
Drew Henson jumps to mind,
you know,
for sure.
But the reality of it is that you spend that money because every now and then you get that one guy.
You get Matt Holliday.
You get Matt Holliday.
Every
you get Desmond
Holliday.
Jennings.
But I mean, Holliday's a guy who they had to buy, if there were slots, he would have gotten definitely above slot bonus in 1998 when he first signed. And 3 years later, they had to give him more money to stay away from Oklahoma State. I think it's also funny that you look at the Yankees' list. Their 2002 top pick, Brandon Whedon, another two-sport guy. They bought him out of football. When he failed in baseball, he went back to football, and he got some time at quarterback this year at Oklahoma State. So, I mean, like,
and
the Yankees are very, very well-practiced in two-sport, whether you're talking about John Elway 30 years ago, you're talking about Brandon Whedon 6 years ago, or Drew Henson, or you're talking about Austin Jackson, or C.J. Henry, the 2005 first-rounder, who's now playing basketball at Kansas.
And that's the thing is that the danger also of two-sport guys is baseball is the hardest sport
right.
to be good at right away. Like, you know, the reality of it is that if you're a two-sport star and you choose baseball, you're probably going to have some point during the next couple of years where you're going to think back and go, you know, if I was playing football or if I was playing basketball, I would be doing this, and it would be in front of a much bigger crowd and
right.
probably with more success.
And the other part of this Yankees discussion, and I do think, like I said before, I think Brackman's inclusion is a sign of the weakness of the Yankees farm system, and it got weaker in their Javier Vasquez trade where they lost essentially two top 10 guys because without Aroldis Vizcaíno, who was number 3, Mike Dunn would have moved into the top 10, and then he's traded as well, and I honestly could not remember from the prospect handbook who the next two guys were in that Yankees list. I believe Corbin Joseph was one of them, and I believe that I can't even remember who the other guy was.
If you did the top 10 and you don't remember,
I cannot even remember who the other guy is. I'm actually going to go on the prospect handbook file and find it before we sign off.
We'll have that for you in the...
We'll have it next time. I can't remember. I honestly, for the life of me, cannot remember who their other guy would have been, but that's going to have to be in a future SBA. Send those in to Jim Callis at SBA@baseballamerica.com. Again, for the podcast, you can send those emails to us at podcast@baseballamerica.com. So for JJ, I'm John, and again, we came to you from the DeMarini Demo House podcast nook. And when it comes to buying a baseball bat, DeMarini just changed the game. Introducing Demo House, where you can step into the cage and hit the latest from DeMarini before you buy, because there's no substitute for hitting a real baseball or talking to people who know both bats and batting. Your demo time in the cage is free. Get the season started right. Visit your nearest Demo House today. Locations and full details can be found at DeMarini.com/Demo House. For JJ, I'm John. We'll see you next time on the Baseball America podcast. So long, everyone.